Have you noticed that politicians struggle to enact the things they run on? That regardless of who wins elections, lawmakers find they cannot pass whatever legislation they like. They're bound by what is popular, or at least their sense of it. They can only act within a narrow set of ideas, and that range is called the Overton Window. And on the Overton Window podcast, we look at issues around the country and talk to the people who change what is politically possible. Now, since the pandemic, a number of red states have given all K-12 students scholarships for their parents to use to best educate their children. But Purple State Pennsylvania has been doing scholarships for a long time, and we're going to dig into how it got this policy and what it means for other states. So we're joined with joined by Elizabeth Stell, the Director of Policy Analysis at the Commonwealth Foundation, a free market think tank in Pennsylvania. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thank you, James. It's good to be back.
What scholarships are available to students in Pennsylvania?
So Pennsylvania has one of the oldest tax credit scholarship programs in the nation. It's broken out into a couple different categories, but essentially lower to mid-income families can qualify for a tax credit scholarship. But the amount of tax credits available every year changes based on whatever the legislature passes. So in Pennsylvania, we've seen a steady growth in the caps on our tax credit scholarship program, to the fact that we've been able to quadruple the number of tax credits available, the amount of tax credits available over the past 10 years. So even though we're a very purple state, we have a Democrat governor, our legislature is split between Democrat and Republican control. Every year for the past 4 years, we've seen an increase in our tax credit scholarship program because it's just become status quo, accepted, expected that this program grows every single year. And while we haven't been able to launch any new programs yet, we are getting closer every year to adding to that list of new programs and more options for families in Pennsylvania.
How did it become expected that this program would grow? Because in most places around the country, it's expected that they don't exist at all.
Yeah. And it's really interesting, the contrast between, for instance, this year, what happened in Illinois versus what happened in Pennsylvania. Illinois had a very small tax credit program, and they killed it this year. In Pennsylvania, it grew over $150 million. And that was because our marquee policy, which was an education savings account, did not move. So this was sort of the fallback position, which is interesting because we serve in Pennsylvania more kids through our tax credit scholarship program than states like Georgia or states like Oklahoma that have a variety of programs, partially because we're a bigger state, but mostly because we've had this program and we've just grown it year after year after year. And the reason it's become expected is because there's a larger constituency every year. More students, more families are benefiting from this program. It's becoming more well-known. And I think really the key situation in Pennsylvania came from the Wolf administration about 4 years ago. Our governor at that point had ran for office campaigning that he was going to end the scholarship tax credit. He was going to eliminate that program. In fact, it grew more under his administration than the administration yet. So it just shows you know, the popularity. When we pull popularity of this program, it's usually in the 70s, regardless of party, regardless of urban, bowl, across the board. And I think it's just because of its staying power. And as more kids, more families take advantage of it, have an experience with it, it becomes that much more difficult to roll back to the point that it's not a question of, are you going to have an expansion? It's a question of how much is the expansion going to be? But that, I think, is a really important lesson learned for other states, that it's worth fighting for those small incremental gains year after year. It shouldn't be the only thing that we're striving to do in our states, but it should definitely be part of the conversation because those things are a lot easier to do politically speaking. And if you do that for 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, you're in a much stronger position to expand the open window even further in terms of education choice.
What are the, so I assume that there's a bunch of the same headwinds that you get on this issue in Pennsylvania that Illinois received, or that lawmakers in Illinois received about this program. So why isn't the teachers union more effective at eliminating these tax credits in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think we've done a good job in Pennsylvania of telling the stories, taking lawmakers to the schools that are benefiting from these programs, pairing constituents with the representatives in these areas that are being pressured to vote against the program. We've had a couple of Democrats stand up and say we support these programs and actually fight for them. So that makes it much more difficult as an unified entity to fight against them. And I think that that is really what it comes down to, is they're hearing from people on the ground why these programs matter, why they want them. And they're caught in the middle between what the teacher unions want and what their constituents want. And so the default position is just avoid a vote at all possible costs so that they can't be on the record opposing these programs. And when there was a piece of legislation in the House this year to roll back the program, we made sure everyone was aware of this, and folks on the left and the right were inundated by emails from parents, from schools. We know the teachers unions are good at this game. They'll send out an alert and they get 50, 100 emails, phone calls, what have you, from members. But we saw an even stronger response from the schools and the families that were under attack by this bill. And that, I think, woke a lot of people up, that if you can actually motivate and engage everyone who benefits from this program, it's extremely difficult that pressure is extremely difficult to overcome. And it's much easier, to get people motivated when something they have is going away versus asking them to advocate for something new that they don't have yet. So I think that's also a factor. But I think that's really it. It's working with the schools. It's working with the communities. It's trying to put a face and a name on the issue. And it's we're also unique in the sense that because of this program, we've been able to, it's not an exaggeration, we've been able to save dozens, even hundreds of Catholic schools across Pennsylvania that otherwise would not exist today. They depend, their existence is dependent on this program. And that's, I think, a big reason why we've been successful in Pennsylvania.
And that's the value that you and your colleagues have been providing to this debate. I mean, obviously, there's some of the intellectual case for school choice that you made, but it sounds like where the most effective thing you've done to try and protect and expand these programs is finding the people who are affected and then help organizing them and helping them tell their stories. So who are these people? Can you tell me about some of them?
Yeah. So we did a whole series last year talking to moms in schools in the Philadelphia area about why these programs are important to them and what they would do or how their lives would change if we had an ESA program. Because we're always looking, going offense here and push the envelope further, not just, defend what we have, but expand. So this was a campaign that was focused on what we call Lifeline Scholarships, which is the name for our ESA push. But their stories were very compelling. One mom is from the Kensington area of Philadelphia. And if you pay attention at all to news on crime and drugs, you might have heard of Kensington as it's basically a war zone. People openly using drugs, the all open air drug markets, needles everywhere. It's just a war zone. So one of the worst places in Philadelphia, this mom and wanted something better for her son. And so she found the Gloria Academy. It's not a religious school. It's a secular school, but it's safe, and the expectations for academic achievement are high. And her son's been able to excel to the point that he's getting ready to go to college now. We're talking about, from a family who he doesn't have single relatives. that's ever been to any sort of higher education before. So this is really breaking the mold for this family. We talked to a mom in Harrisburg. We just did a series of these videos, The Apprentice. And she struggles. She works extra jobs to make sure that her children can continue to attend a private school in Harrisburg. And her school situation is actually a hybrid academy. That was part virtual, part person. And she took the governor at his word that he was going to sign the Lifeline bill. Now, he said he supported it 2 years ago. And when he backed down, she was very angry. And so we had a conversation with her talking about how she felt betrayed by the governor. There are so many different stories. We tell lots of different stories in lots of different ways. But honestly, James, the number one reason that parents tell us these programs isn't so much that they're worried about what their child's going to be when they grow up. It's basic things like safety and an escape from bullying. We told a story of a family whose son was constantly bullied because he was biracial. And so he got a scholarship to go to a Catholic school to get away from that situation. So it's very basic stuff. And I think sometimes we miss that. We just assume that it's about, academics, and it is to an extent. But unfortunately, for so many of the failing schools in Pennsylvania, the number one issue is something as simple as safe, not getting beat up, not being exposed to violence.
Well, I mean, that also emphasizes the emergent properties of competition, which is once you give people options, they might exercise them for reasons that you don't expect. And having a thriving marketplace for education can ensure that for these things that you might not think about, but a lot of people do think and care about safety, but that they're given other alternatives. You mentioned that your current governor betrayed one of the families involved, or so one of the families that you found. What's the deal with your governors?
What's the deal?
I mean, you said that the previous one campaigned against it and wound up expanding it. What's going on with your current governor?
So the current governor campaigned on saying we can expand traditional funding for public education and create a pathway for kids trapped in failing schools. In Pennsylvania, because of our tax credit scholarship program, the State Department of Education has put together a list of the bottom 15% performing schools every single year. And kids who are assigned to those schools qualify for a subset of our tax credit programs called the Opportunity Scholarship Program. And basically, this is about targeted reform, right? We want to help the kids that are in the absolute worst situation. And these are schools that have abysmal test scores, they have safety issues, and year after year, they're on this list. And there are several schools in this list that have zero kids doing math at grade level. Not a single kid in that school is doing math at grade level. So that just gives you a picture of how dysfunctional these schools are. And so the governor said, yeah, we should continue to pour more money into public education in line with his party's platform. But we can also create an off-ramp, an alternative for the kids that are stuck in schools that are completely failing to do their job year after year. And that was very controversial. Teachers didn't like it. A lot of people were very uncomfortable with that. But he's a smart man. He sees the polling. He sees the national trends. He knows that this is a winning issue. And if you can get beyond the partisanship, people agree. So he came out saying both and. Yes and. But he didn't really do anything to make it happen. So it became if it gets to my desk, I'll sign it sort of situation. And because we have a divided legislature, it was a big challenge to get that to its desk.
By the way, that's one of the tactics that often happen. Like, yes, I will support this, but behind the scenes, I will work to make sure that it never gets to my desk.
Yes. Yeah, what they're saying publicly in the rhetoric and then what they're actually doing. Yes. So the governor was very consistent in his rhetoric. But what happened is when it came to actually sign the program into existence, the Democrats in Pennsylvania balked and basically threatened to blow up the entire budget if he didn't veto this program. So he actually went and vetoed his own campaign promise. And then even after that said, I'm still open to it. So we're like, well, we'll test that hypothesis. And so again, it became the number one issue in the state budget this year, Lifeline scholarships. It came back. But this time, unfortunately, we weren't able to get it into the final budget bill. And so the governor didn't have to line up to it again. But he still says he supports it. So the rhetoric is still there, which I think shows the shift in the Overton window. The walk to go with that talk is still coming, but it's moving in the right direction. And if there were a change in the legislature's makeup, you know, that door could open very quickly. In fact, we also saw movement in our Senate passing a refundable tax credit. So this is a much simpler school choice solution than tax credit scholarships. Literally, you know, file it on your taxes for an $8,000 refundable tax credit so you can send your kid to a school of their choice. That passed in the Senate committee, and that came out of nowhere. And the only reason that that came up is because senators were frustrated on the governor's refusal to actually put muscle behind his promise. So that tension is actually helping us open the Overton window for other school choice solutions, because we understand that it's, you know, it's not just one program. You want to give families as many choices as possible. Like you said, as much competition as possible and come in many different forms.
What's the partisan fight like? How many school choice Democrats are there, and how many anti-school choice Republicans are there in Pennsylvania?
Well, it's what they say behind closed doors is different from what they say publicly. You know, like what you were saying about the governor. There are folks that I think are sincerely concerned about the lack of options for their constituents when it comes to public education. But they can't be for it because of the political pressures. So it's more a situation of we have a lot of folks, I'd say, who are neutral in action, but aren't there with us in terms of the rhetoric. They're not speaking out. They're not being proactive in their advocacy. So on the Dem side, you know, there are quite a few that maybe are with us in spirit, but aren't going to do anything to make it happen. There are two that are vocal supporters of school choice. Representative Wellman Brown and Senator Tony Williams have both taken some very hard votes over the years on these issues. And there are a couple of others that have made, you know, some good votes, but they're the two that are most outspoken. And then on the Republican side, I think Pennsylvania has been really successful in bringing along, you know, the vast majority of Republicans. They're seeing that this isn't an inner city issue, which is usually how it gets, you know, painted in lots of states, urban versus rural. We don't have that situation in Pennsylvania because we're taking them to these rural, typically Christian schools, not always. They're beginning to see the micro schools. They're beginning to see a lot of the innovations spurred by the pandemic and how that's benefiting their local communities. And we now have students in every single county in Pennsylvania that receive a tax credit scholarship. So there are people in their own backyard, no matter, you know, which part of Pennsylvania they live in, that are benefiting from these programs. So it's we don't really have debates on the Republican side anymore. It's pretty much just expected that if you're not going to be advocating for these issues, you're not going to be opposed to them. And we have great leadership in our Senate that's really bought into this and sees it as, you know, one of the most important issues in Pennsylvania because, as you know, James, kind of some ways like Michigan and lots of other Midwestern states, we have a big population problem. We're aging very fast. Losing our young people. And so they see school choices as one way to tackle the brain drain.
So I want to dig in a little more on some of the political calculation that goes in for our elected officials. Is that I think for the Republicans, there's a constituency of some of our voters who encouraged school choice, and there's the rest of the School Choice Coalition. And so it's all benefits, it's no cost for them. But if you're on the Democratic side, there may be some of your constituents who support this, but I'm pretty sure they're all facing costs for standing out on school choice. Even though you have two school choice Democrats, I'm sure they're under a lot of pressure to change their position.
Yeah, absolutely. The labor unions of Pennsylvania give almost exclusively, more than 95% of their PACs are donated to Democrats, not Republicans. So you're potentially giving up a lot of campaign support when you make these votes. The worst case scenario for lawmakers, you're basically inviting people to primary you, to find a primary challenger who's going to toe that line. So it's a high cost. It's a big risk. We've seen a few folks do it. It's not easy. They've run in some pretty tough re-elections because of it. But I think they're on the winning side of history. And I think it's just, a matter of time as these issues circle back around to where we were in the 90s, late 90s, where it was a bipartisan idea to do education reform. It was, everyone was on the school choice bandwagon. Cory Booker and friends, it was a great thing. I think we're swinging back around to that, but it will take time. And it's also why in Pennsylvania, the Connellation was a law on union reform. It's not as visible right now as it has been in other years, but making sure that we're evening the playing field, have good laws around what labor unions can and can't do in terms of their political activities, goes a long way in helping with these other sorts of issues. So it all works together. I don't expect that we'll have a lot of Democrats make that tough choice anytime soon in Pennsylvania. I think what's going to happen is over time, they're just going to become more of a silent partner, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's going to be more sort of the Josh Shapiro approach of, well, if it comes up for a vote, I'm not going to vote against it, but they're certainly not going to do anything to help it come to fruition. And we're also challenging our schools in Pennsylvania to be more outspoken about this. So when their representatives come to ask them, why did you vote against this program expansion? Why did you vote to limit the tax credit scholarship program? Why did you vote against, an amendment to this bill for lifeline scholarships? And really educating them on some of the more technical votes that happen that don't get a lot of attention, but are really litmus tests and really show what they're doing on the issue, not just what they're saying. So we have a big challenge in Pennsylvania, and I'm sure this happens in other states, where a lawmaker will say, I'm for choice. Like, yes, choice is great. Like, your school and what you're doing here is fantastic. And then we'll go to the Capitol and we'll vote against them. So we're trying to be that conduit to make sure that they're not able to play both sides going forward. And I think we're seeing some success. They're feeling pressure now from multiple sides, not just from all the union folks that are supporting the campaign.
So what's it going to take to move this from some Democrats to support this to the majority of Democrats support this, and therefore victory?
Yeah, I do. It's a good question. I think really it just comes down to bringing up hard votes for them, forcing them to vote on these things over and over again. Mm-hmm. That's going to be the path to victory, because they're going to eventually have a record of voting in favor of these things, and that's going to really be very difficult to change course. Mm-hmm. So that's really our strategy, is to keep bringing up bills, lots of different types of bills, keep making them vote on things, do as much as we can to get very clear votes on the record of where they stand. That's the most powerful thing that we have. And then bring that back home to the communities to show them how their representatives and senators are actually, supporting their interests or voting against their interests, and then moving forward from there. But we have so much work to do, James, in terms of motivating these communities to get involved. So many times the mindset in a lot of these states is, you know, I have a school to run. I don't have time to do anything else. I don't want to get involved in the politics. Like, I can't. Like, And what we're trying to show people is that this is an opportunity, and that what we're offering is not just, you know, the ability for you to continue to survive, but the ability for you to thrive. And we understand very keenly the challenge that other states are now experiencing, which is when you pass these programs, you need the supply, right? You have all these children out there looking for an alternative, and there are no schools for them to attend. You have a big problem, and you're not going to have a successful rollout of that policy, and that could lead to backtracks, right? And that could lead to closing the open window. And so we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to engage schools to allow them to grow and serve that new demand that we're hoping to create maybe very soon.
What lessons do you think your experience has had for the broader school choice movement?
You know, I think persistence is really important. keep going. Every year, keep running the bills. You know, build up your champions, equip them, defend them. You don't know when you're finally going to move over that, you know, the top of the hill, push that boulder over the mountain, whatever cliche you're going to use. You don't know when that moment is going to come, so you need to do everything possible to keep the pressure on, because it will come if you continue to keep that pressure on. And I think that's what we've seen in Pennsylvania, is that because we've been consistently pushing this issue for over a decade, I mean, in the case of tax credit scholarships, you know, 2 decades, we're going on 3 decades soon, you will get those incremental victories. You will expand your constituency, and that's only going to make you more influential, more difficult to ignore. And, you know, ultimately, I think for a lot of these things, it comes down to who the governor is, right? And I don't know if they want to take a stand on leading. We've seen that in Texas. We've seen that in Iowa. You know, people playing some pretty hard ball to get this done. We haven't, unfortunately, had that opportunity in Pennsylvania. So our pathway has been a little slower, but we're continuing to push that window because we are persistent with our legislative leaders. You know, whatever you have, whether it's one chamber, two chambers, a governor, whatever, you know, your constituency looks like in terms of education freedom, use that to your advantage to keep pushing the issues forward, to keep telling the stories, to keep showing the success in other places, and you'll get there. You know, the arguments against you are going to change. We're getting a lot of pushback now on this idea that kids with special education needs won't have any place to go. No schools can serve them. Public schools can serve them. Well, we're finding out through some research we're doing that a lot of private schools have contracts with public schools to serve kids with the most intense special needs. So it's actually the opposite in many communities. The private schools are better equipped to serve these kids with lots of needs. You always have to be ready for whatever the new push against you is. But I think, you know, the secret is to just keep pushing it, because you don't know when you're going to have that, you know, that moment to make something happen. And I'm so excited to see it taking off in so many different states. You know, Louisiana was a really exciting one this year. There's so much happening. And I hope that we'll be able to add Pennsylvania very soon to that list. But in the meantime, you know, I'm really proud of the work that we've been able to do, the fact that we're serving, you know, more than 50,000 kids every single year through this program. The fact that we have in many years more donors than tax credits available, we have to actually turn businesses away because of the caps. It's a great problem to have. We're working to fix that so that everyone who wants to donate can. But that just shows you the
and hunger for the structure of the program is that businesses donate, they receive a tax credit for this, and there is simply, but the tax credit is capped, so not everyone who tries to apply can do that, not everyone who applies can actually obtain the credit they
can
want.
Take the credit, yeah, to the point where, you know, within a week, once the program opens, usually within a week it's fully subscribed. I mean, it's, you know, people are ready and waiting. Because there's so much demand. I mean, and it makes a lot of sense, James. I mean, who wouldn't want to send their tax dollars to maybe their local community schools instead of the capital? And then they get spent on who knows what. I mean, that's a very attractive proposition for folks. we have some issues in Pennsylvania with the actual execution of the program. People are waiting a very long time to get their refunds. We have some work to do there. But I think the fact that it continues to grow in terms of the caps really shows you that it has a momentum of its own now. And now the question is, how do we leverage that into bigger and better things for Pennsylvania families? How do we move to programs that are even easier to administer and execute? And how ultimately do we better serve our kids, which is what this is all about.
Elizabeth, good luck in your attempts to shift the Overton window.
Thanks, James.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Overton Window, a podcast from the Mackinac Center. Please subscribe and rate. For more, check us out at www.mackinac.org. That's Mackinac with a C, like the island.